Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, as usual, we have good news, bad news, crazy news for conservatives. We start with the good news from a rather unlikely source, and that's the mainstream media. Bill Plant, longtime White House correspondent for CBS News, appearing on CNN's Reliable Sources to talk about the White House press corps' ongoing and growing frustration with President Obama and their lack of access to him. This kind of boiled over when he did that golfing trip over President's Day weekend, and the press was kept at a great distance for an extended period of time. Ed Henry of Fox News is the White House Press Association president right now and filed a formal complaint. Bill Plant, asked by Howard Kurtz on Reliable Sources, don't you guys come off as looking kind of whiny? Here's what Bill Plant had to say.
This is not about a picture of Tiger Woods. This is about access to the president. And access to the president has been cut and pushed and curtailed over every administration I've covered. And here's the nub of it, Howie. This administration has the tools to reach people on their own. They don't need us as much. And to the extent that they're able to do that, they're undercutting the First Amendment, which guarantees a free press through many voices. If they put out their own material, it's state-run media.
State-run media, that's something you'd expect to hear from Rush Limbaugh or someone else, Jim. So it's good that Bill Plant is lurching to the freezing out process here. The problem is, of course, is that it looks like this whole feud is going to go away because Obama's going to attend the gridiron dinner. So clearly this is a big beef on the part of the press corps. They're frustrated, but their liberal bent just won't let them actually push this as far as it needs to go. But the fact that they're out there saying it publicly is a good thing.
You know, the thing is that maybe you're going to see this boiling over, and that maybe a little bit of make nice at these dinners won't be enough. Because here's the thing. Does the press really care that much, as he said, about the golf trip? No, not really. But if Obama was doing regular press events and he were regularly taking questions during photo ops, like his event with the first responders last week, and I don't believe he took any questions, he's going to do an event in Newport News tomorrow, spending $180,000 to fly Air Force One down and back for 1 hour to denounce the terrible spending cuts under sequestration, to basically give the exact same speech he did earlier in the week. Now, if he took questions, nobody would be caring about the golf trips. But they complain about the golf trips because the administration, you know, doesn't like to do the questions do tough questions. They'd much rather do The View. As we know, the president hasn't done an interview in the past year with New York Times, Washington Post, Politico, or Wall Street Journal, any one of their White House reporters. Now, he'll do the local television reporters who are going to ask kind of a, if not softball, certainly the generic ones. But you're not going to get a Jake Tapper who's going to have the follow-ups and really press the president. We've already seen 60 Minutes decide that it wasn't there to give the president gotcha questions in their happy sit-down with the president and Hillary Clinton. So, you know, the question that Bill Plant is asking here is, where are the tough questions going to come from? And it's a perfectly legitimate question for him to ask, and that's why they're making such a stink about closing this out. Because the White House would be perfectly happy if you got all of your information about what they're doing from whitehouse.gov, from their Facebook page, from their social media, all the different YouTube videos that they distribute. They want you to get it straight from the White House itself, and not getting any reporter getting in the way who might give messages the White House doesn't want you to have. And I think state-run media does become a same. It's not to say, you know, we on the right may throw around that term because we think the White House, you know, reporters are offering softballs. But the irony is they don't even get the chance to offer softballs that much anymore. And what they're doing, the social media techniques of the White House, are state-run media. That's not an exaggeration. I think they should be called out for what they are, because I think when you hear that, you think propaganda. And, well, Greg, that's what it is, isn't it?
Absolutely is what it is. And we'll see, as you mentioned, whether or not the press corps that has a natural affinity for Obama and certainly for his policies will actually call him on it for it. We knew if this happened in the previous administration, there'd be blood on the floor practically in the White House press room. So we'll find out just how much these folks are willing to defend the First Amendment. On to martini number two now. And Jim and I are both very frustrated, and frustrated at the Republican governor of Virginia. Bob McDonnell was elected back in 2009. We've had, for the most part, very good things to say about him. We both, in different years, named him our most underrated political figure. But Bob McDonnell is not going out of office on a very good note. First of all, he fell in love with toll roads a couple of years ago, and he's essentially absent without leave when it comes to a potential civil war that could easily cost the Republicans the governor's race this year, which would perhaps make Terry McAuliffe our next governor. But here's the coup de grace. This is something Bob McDonnell thinks is great, and here's how the Wall Street Journal puts it. There's one thing uglier than a Democratic tax and spend spree, a Republican one. On Friday, Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell and a GOP-run legislature approved a five-year, $6 billion transportation bill financed almost entirely with higher sales and car taxes. The big winners are unions, real estate developers, and the transit lobby. Taxpayers didn't fare so well. The sales tax rises to 6% from 5% in Hampton Roads and populous Northern Virginia, and to 5.3% everywhere else. The hated car tax, which Republicans once vowed to eliminate, rises from 3% to 4.3%, meaning a new $30,000 car or truck will come with a $1,290 tax bill, and that's every year, mind you. Then there's a new 0.25% sales tax on homes in Northern Virginia, plus a new hotel tax. Mr. McDonnell claims that with this bill, gas prices will be reduced because he's eliminated the 17.5 cents a gallon gas tax. Yet he's replaced it with a more hidden 3.5% tax on the wholesale price of gas. With wholesale prices nearing $4 a gallon, this is a 14 cents a gallon tax. The new levy will automatically rise with inflation and oil price spikes, which means over time, the McDonnell gas tax cut may be an increase. And if you think that's bad enough, think about what he thinks he needed to do to get Democrats to go along with this, since the Republicans control both houses. Here's Julie Carey of NBC4.
Governor Bob McDonnell pushed hard for the transportation plan. It could become his legacy initiative. But he also gave in return assurance to Democrats that he will consider expanding health care coverage for the poor.
So, Democrats, if you vote for tax increases, we'll expand Medicaid. Gee, I can't imagine why they went along with that, Jim.
I am maybe one notch less frustrated with McDonnell than you are in that. So if you talk to most Virginia Republicans, they understood that the, you know, state has a lot of overdue transportation work. And the, you know, argument was that some folks are saying, well, okay, it's time to raise the gas tax, which is traditionally how it has been spent. No one was particularly enthusiastic about that. McDonnell's original plan was to eliminate the gas tax and move it to and replace that by increasing the sales tax. And the argument is, look, as people drive more fuel-efficient vehicles, gas usage actually goes down or doesn't increase nearly as much as the wear and tear on roads. So the idea was get rid of the gas tax, increase the sales tax. You'll actually raise more revenue this way. And then, you know, the usual folks are saying, wait a minute, that's not fair. What if I don't use gas, you know? But I buy things. What if I, you know, don't I end up, you're paying people who don't use the roads. And I started asking myself, who actually doesn't use roads, Greg? I mean, maybe if you're a hermit somewhere out in the woods in the mountains and you never actually leave your house, you raise your own food, you never order something from Amazon and have something delayed. Because here's the thing, everything on the shelves at the store, that got there not through teleportation, not by somebody walking there, you know, by trucks and cars using roads. So I didn't really mind the idea of shifting from the gas tax to the sales tax. Where this deal particularly stinks is that, you know, as laid out in that Wall Street Journal editorial, is that, yeah, we're getting that hike in the sales tax, but we're not really getting the offsetting elimination of the gas tax. They're saying that we are, but by putting a wholesale gas increase, we're getting a slight reduction in one tax for a significant increase in another tax, and it strikes me as just a bad deal. I'm not angry that McDonnell wanted to address this. I think the need was real and serious. You know, the argument is always, well, why can't you get it out of the general fund? And I'd love to see where, you know, I'm open to that. I just want to know where people want, you know, money from the general fund to be shifted from. And it just kind of struck me as a very frustrating one. I think it was like there are a lot of reasons to not like this bill. Yes, it was trying to acknowledge a serious need, but it kind of looks like, you know, you wonder how much McDonnell wanted to get a deal in his final year in office to kind of say, look, I did it and was really willing to give up a lot of ground in what seems like, you know, minor details, but they turn out to be pretty darn serious details.
Certainly true. And he's a guy who campaigned vigorously in 2009 about not raising taxes. So there is a broken promise there. The Republicans, as we mentioned, control the assembly by a wide margin. It's actually split 20-20 in the Senate, but the lieutenant governor breaks the ties. And so Republicans clearly went along with this in the assembly. Not a good day for Bob McDonnell, and not a good argument for Republicans when you go out there and say we'll be the ones to protect your wallet and things like this happen. So on to martini number three now. And if you thought that was crazy, let's bring back Michael Bloomberg, mayor of New York City. His much vaunted large soda ban goes into effect March 12th. That'd be the 32-ounce soda. But if you thought it was just that simple, Jim, not even close. According to the New York Post, say goodbye to that 2-liter bottle of Coke with your pizza delivery. pitchers of soft drinks at your kid's birthday party, and some bottle service mixers at your favorite nightclub. Typically, a pizzeria charges $3 for a 2-liter bottle of Coke, but under the ban, customers would have to buy 6 12-ounce cans at a total cost of $7.50 to get an equal amount of soda. Now, if you want to take your kids out for a birthday party, these Chuck E. Cheese-type places have to pitch their plastic pitchers because most hold 60 ounces, and even though many more than one person will be drinking out of it, doesn't matter. That has to go. And on the more ritzy side, if you're looking for a nice bottle of vodka, for example, spending $300 on a bottle of vodka no longer entitles you to a full complement of mixers. Here's where it really gets bureaucratic. The carafes in which mixers are typically served hold 32 ounces, and the most common mixers, sodas, cranberry juice, and tonic water, will be limited. Only water and 100% juice will be unlimited. Alcoholic drinks and diet sodas are not subject to the ban, nor are fruit smoothies if they don't have added sweetener, or coffee drinks, and milkshakes if made with 50% milk. But what about drinks with small amounts of added sugar? Vendors must determine if the beverages have more than 3.125 calories per ounce.
Oh, my God.
Good luck.
Break out your abacuses, bartenders. Utterly ridiculous. And I think that, as John Podoritz had said over this weekend, sometimes you get the feeling Mike Bloomberg wants to be mocked, that he really wants to make his city a laughingstock. You're looking at that and you're thinking, why is this the business of the city? Why can't you buy as much soda as you want? So it's illegal to go to a Chuck E. Cheese in New York and purchase a pitcher of soda.
Right.
Why is it legal, then, to purchase a 2-liter bottle of soda in a supermarket?
Good question.
I shouldn't speak too loudly and give Bloomberg the idea. He'll probably ban the, you know the new mini cans of Coke that they have now?
Right.
Which is basically like one mouthful. He'll start distributing it like that. You'll only be able to get it in like the smallest possible containers possible. I just don't understand the mentality, the argument, why New Yorkers are not rising up against this. You wonder if, like, how much of this is, like, the low-information voters just kind of tuning it out. And then once they actually, you know, these laws go into effect, then you'll see the ridiculous outrage and people saying, you got to be kidding me. I do find also the exceptions to Bloomberg's favorite, you know, latte drinks also kind of ridiculous. New York, what are you doing? What are you doing? Wake up. Rise up, New Yorkers. Remember that this was a tough town? You know, sharp elbows and, you know, nobody tells us what to do and D's and don'ts and all that. What's going on, New York? Come on. You know, you've turned into, if I want to be mean, I'd say Boston. You know, just because I know it gets under New Yorkers' skin. But, like, even in Boston, they can drink as much soda. Even in, like, Berkeley, you can drink as much soda as you want. A happy citizen in Orwell's 1984 was able to drink as much soda as he wanted. Weird start to the week, Greg.
Yes. So stick with us the rest of the week. Hopefully the good martinis will get better and the bad and the crazy will dissipate a little bit. Jim, have a great day.
Looking forward to seeing you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus at Radio America. Please join us again on Tuesday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.